team. Thank you to everyone that's been participating in this service. Again, it's my favorite weekend of the year because to me it has such significance. But to find some of that significance, we have to take a bit of a step back. And as I've been thinking about the significance of Easter, we have to ask the question about loss. Do you know what it's like to experience loss? Do you know what it's like to mourn? Maybe you've lost a house in a fire. Maybe you've lost the dream job that you've worked your whole life to achieve. Maybe you've lost the retirement that you've worked your whole life for. Maybe you've lost mobility to a devastating accident. Most of us here know what it's like to mourn in some way or another. Most of us know what it's like to lose. And in the early hours of the Sunday after Jesus' death, the spirits of Jesus' closest followers were at an all-time low. That when Pastor Franklin earlier said that they did not expect Jesus to come back to life was no understatement. These men and women were in mourning. Not just because they had lost somebody they cared for, but because they had lost the hope of somebody they believed would rescue them. They'd been given hope by this man named Jesus, and in his death was not the hope that we attribute to it. The cross was not a symbol of hope to them. The cross was a symbol of failure. And for 3 years, especially the closest 12 men that followed with him and several women that were very close to him, they traveled with him day after day after day over miles and miles and miles. They learned from Jesus. They taught with Jesus. They encountered and they witnessed miracles by Jesus. And they believed that he would be the one to set God's people free. And maybe for the first time in their lives, they believed that maybe God's promises would come to pass. That maybe God was listening after all. That maybe God actually cared. And on that Sunday morning, all they knew was failure. The followers of Jesus expected to come into Jerusalem and be conquering heroes. In fact, last Sunday is an event in the church calendar called Palm Sunday, and it gets that name because Jesus entered into Jerusalem on a donkey, as had been prophesied that the Messiah would do, and he came to great fanfare. People called him the Son of David, which was a Hebrew way of saying, "You are the king." But less than a week later, the crowds had turned and Jesus was dead. Their Lord and Master, their teacher and friend, had been killed by an unjust crowd, guilty of no wrongs. The man who had offered hope to the hopeless and healing to the sick and wounded, freedom to captives and forgiveness to sinners, was in a cave. And there was no coming back from this. Because that's how it ends, right? That's death is how it ends. There is no coming back from that. What life is there for the followers of an executed Messiah? So in these early mornings hours on this Sunday, these disciples, these followers of Jesus, sat and mourned as those who had no hope. It's hard for us as modern readers to look back and to read this story with fresh eyes, because most of us know how the story ends. It's so ingrained in our thinking that we can't even see how they didn't see this coming. If you read through the stories of the life of Jesus in Matthew and in Mark and in Luke and in John, Jesus continually and consistently says, "I must die, but I will rise again." But for whatever reason, whether it was just a lack of understanding, whether it was some kind of spiritual blindness that they had, they still didn't get it. In fact, John chapter 20, verse 9 says that they still hadn't understood the scriptures that said Jesus must rise from the dead. All they knew, all they understood was the person that they loved, the person in whom they had placed their trust, the person who believed in them when the world had given up on them, was gone. And for these men and women, the question of why had to ring out in their hearts. Why didn't it change? Why didn't God intervene? Jesus even cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" They heard this as he hung on the cross. Why didn't God stop this? Why didn't God come to his aid? If God was ever going to come to somebody's aid, why not Jesus? And at this point, all they knew and all they saw was that Jesus' life was a tragedy. That Jesus' life was the tale of a man who claimed to be the Messiah and was proven wrong. Because Jesus wasn't the first, nor would he be the last, to claim that mantle. The Messiah was a promised figure that the people of God, the Jewish people, had been expecting for centuries. And many people rose up and claimed to be that Messiah and gathered armies and pitted themselves against their oppressors. But each time, it ended the same way. Every single time, these messiahs ended up dead. So why couldn't this have been different? For these people, all they knew was pain. For these people, all they knew was tragedy. And as a pastor, I've become acquainted with pain. One of the most difficult aspects of my job is walking with people in seasons of the most difficult times of their life. Whether it's the loss of a job, whether it's the loss of a relationship, or the loss of a loved one, I've had to walk through these seasons of untold misery. When that question of why comes up, and so often I don't have an answer. And it's unimaginable, and it puts my own complaints into perspective. But sitting with the daughters of a man who committed suicide, you are not really prepared for. You're not prepared for loving on a family whose wife and mother was taken at far too young an age by cancer. To walk with a family as they try to pick up the pieces of a house that had been burnt to the ground. I think the hardest tragedy that I've ever had to walk through, though, was in my last position at my last church, and it was a cold December day afternoon, and I was coming back to the church was called Buena Vista. And I got a call on Route 90, on I-90, on the thruway, coming back from Syracuse, where my wife's family lives. and this couple that I hadn't gotten to know particularly well at this point, but their names are Deb and Phil. Now, I've walked through tragedy before, but I've never mourned alongside the victims of a murder-suicide. Their daughter, Elizabeth, had attempted to escape an abusive relationship, and in the process of trying to get to safety, her boyfriend found her. And I don't understand why these kind of things happen. And if that's what you're looking for is answers, I can't tell you that I have them all. Because these seasons hurt and they leave indelible marks on those of us left behind. Tragedy is heavy, it's overwhelming, and in cases like Deb and Phil's, it even leaves me frustrated and confused and overwhelmed. And it leaves me crying out to God, asking why. Like those disciples did so many years ago, why? And maybe that's where you live. Maybe you know what that's like. Maybe you're facing that prospect of life without that loved one and you don't know how you're going to move on. And all that you know is that tragedy that sits in front of you. Maybe you are experiencing the end of a relationship that you've poured yourself into and you don't know how you're going to move on. Maybe you're in a financial situation. Maybe it's of your own making, but it doesn't really matter how you got there. All you know is you don't know how you're going to provide for your family now. And you look ahead and you don't see a clear way out and you ask that question, why? Maybe you're here and you understand how the disciples of Jesus felt that Saturday, because for you, it's been Saturday for a long time. Maybe for you, Saturday is all that you know. For you've lost hope. But something that I've discovered in my life, and often it's been the hard way, often it's been because my family has walked through tragedy, whether it's my uncle's sudden passing, whether it's my brother as the victim of abuse. We know pain, but I've also discovered that the tragedy isn't the end of the story. And even in times when life has shaken me to my core, even when I've come face to face with the hardest situations that I've ever imagined and not understood how I can possibly come through that, I've still discovered that the tragedy isn't the end. And it wasn't the end of the story for Jesus. You see, in John 20, we see tragedy take a turn. In verse 1, John tells us, early on Sunday morning, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and found that the stone had been rolled away from the entrance. She ran and found Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. And she said, "They've taken the Lord's body out of the tomb, and we don't know where they put him." And Peter and the other disciple started out for the tomb, and they were both running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He stooped and looked in and saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he didn't go in. And then Simon Peter arrived and went inside. And he also noticed the linen wrappings lying there. And while the cloth that had covered Jesus' head was folded and lying apart from the other wrappings. And then the disciple who reached the tomb first also went in, and he saw and believed. What John and Peter saw, when they saw the empty tomb and the clothes that Jesus' body had been wrapped in, they knew something had happened. They knew that if somebody had stolen the body, it was likely they'd bring the coverings with him. It's not like they would have unwrapped the body and taken it with them. That wouldn't really make a whole lot of sense. It's the only separation between you and a dead body. And for people in Jesus' day, that was not only uncomfortable, that would have been a religious no-no. So they knew something had happened that they didn't know how to really process it. But somewhere in those next hours, what had been foggy became clear. What had been a mystery to them was suddenly plain as day. They realized and recognized that the events that had preceded this fateful morning, Jesus' betrayal, his torture, and his execution, that had been treated as a tragedy, and by all accounts were the worst possible thing that could have happened to him or to his disciples. But in a moment, God took that tragedy and turned it into triumph. What had seemed like a defeat on Friday transformed into a victory on Sunday. And it's why we celebrate. It's the single thing that turns this from a symbol of torture and a symbol of loss of hope into the symbol of hope that it is today. Because without the resurrection, that is just an instrument of execution. It would be as sick as if we walked around with a guillotine hanging around our neck or an electric chair. That would be weird because those are instruments of death. But the cross for us no longer symbolizes death. It does, but not in the way you would expect. It's why we don't have to mourn Jesus' death. We commemorate it for its significance and its meaning to us, but we do not mourn it. Because of the cross, the death of Jesus is no longer seen as a tragedy. Because that Sunday, Jesus turned it into a triumph. And God is not done turning tragedy into triumph. Before he died, Jesus reminded his followers in John 16, he said, "Here on earth, you will have many trials and sorrows. But take heart, because I have overcome the world." And you may not know this, maybe you do, but the Bible wasn't written originally in English. It was actually written in a couple of different languages, and the book of John, along with the entire New Testament, was written in Greek. And so we have translations of that original Greek, but the original Greek words sometimes are interesting to dive into. And the Greek word Jesus uses here is nikeo, which is where we get the word Nike from. And the word nikeo means to conquer or to carry off to victory. So even in the midst of tragedy, we have the promise that God has overcome and will overcome and will carry us off to victory. Even when our circumstances seem the darkness. The disciple John reminds us of this when he writes 1 John 5:4. And in this letter, he says, "Everyone who is a child of God conquers," and he uses that nikeo word again, "conquers the world. And this is the victory that conquers the world, our faith." Our faith is the tool that God uses to conquer the world. In another fairly well-known verse from the book of Romans, Romans 8:28 tells us, that we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purposes for them. In the midst of our tragedies, it's hard to see this. In fact, it's also easy to kind of get this twisted and say that everything that happens in life is God causing them to happen for his good or for our good. And so we try to find the reason in there, and we are constantly stymied because we can't find the reason why. I can't tell you the reason why my brother was sexually abused at the age of 8, 9, and 10. I don't know. I other than the perversion of humanity, I don't want to know. Because if you try to tell me any reason, it's going to feel pretty darn hollow. And you know what that's like. If you've ever lost a loved one and had somebody well-intentioned try to tell you that God was going to use that death for your good, you probably tell them where to go. It probably wouldn't be heaven. There's a good chance. We can be real, right? Because I've had that. I've lost people that I love, and people have tried to encourage me, encourage in quotes, and I know their heart is good, but it doesn't help. And I gotta tell you, sometimes the answer that we're looking for is not the answer that we need. Sometimes we're looking for the wrong thing. And what God promises is not that we will discover the reason, or that God is causing all of this to happen, and that everything that happens is a part of his plan. Because I gotta tell you, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I realize that God doesn't have to make sense to me. But people like Elizabeth and people like my brother Brody would beg to differ. However, what God does promise is a better promise. What God promises is that everything that happens can be used, can be worked, can be redeemed. That tragedy that doesn't make sense can still be used for good. And I think back to the story of Phil and of Deb. And I'd love to tell you that the answer there is that the answer was a resurrection, and that was how God used her for good. But that's not the story. We mourned her. We buried her. We memorialized her. But I tell you what God did do is God laid it on Elizabeth's mother's heart to dedicate herself to make a difference for other women attempting to escape abusive relationships. And that she has been instrumental and influential in the southern tier of New York to make a difference for young women who are desperate for freedom and desperate for safety. My brother Brody, if you know my story, you know that Brody has been a mess. And Brody will admit that. He doesn't hold back. His life has been an absolute mess for years, over a decade at this point. He has been addicted to multiple different drugs at different times, coping with his abuse through alcoholism, through prescription and illicit drugs. He has almost died at multiple stages of his life, whether it was from directly or indirectly as a result of his addictions. But how God has taken that tragedy and worked to turn it around is that through this, Brody has discovered the depths of God's love and how far God will go for somebody like Brody. And Brody has found that people will listen to him. Because if I'm real, people in Brody's world don't give a rip about what I have to say. I was told, and I am told multiple times, that I am a golden child kind of kid. I'm not that kind of kid. I'm not. I may have a bit of a veneer because I'm a pastor, but I'll give them this. I don't know that world. I don't know the world of addiction. I don't know the world of abuse. I don't know the world of redemption from that life, but my brother does. And Brody has found, as he has wrestled with what does it look like for me to love God and what does it look like for me to have faith in God, after all of this, how can I be a light to the people that are in that gutter like I used to be? And he is still wrestling with this, but the beautiful thing is that he is realizing that he can help people who were where he was get out of where he was without having to go through what he did. They don't have to face death, that they don't have to have overdoses and get to the rock bottom that he was at in order to find God. That their life doesn't have to absolutely fall to pieces to be put back together. I could go on for hours with story after story of tragedies that make no sense, tragedies that I cannot explain, tragedies that I have mourned, but that God has found a way to bring beauty out of it, to bring wholeness out of brokenness, to create a masterpiece out of a life that had been falling apart. But because of this promise, he used those situations to bring about good. Because God is the God that brings victory out of misery. And this chapter in Romans goes on to say, can anything separate us from Christ's love? Does it mean that he no longer loves us if we have trouble or calamity? Or are persecuted or hungry or destitute or in danger or threatened with death? No, despite all of these things, overwhelming victory is ours through Christ who loved us. You may be facing tragedy this morning and you may know what those disciples were like. You may know what my life has been like at multiple times. You may know what my brother's life has been like. And you may have questions, and you may be in pain, and you may feel helpless, and you may be angry. Let me tell you this. There's not a whole lot of things that I can say for certain that I understand, but these are one. This is one area that I get. I'd get it. And I'd love to kind of dig in more, and I'm not going to take the time right now, but let me tell you, if that's where you're at, and you need to have somebody that just kind of gets it even a little bit. I'm here. I make myself available to you because I've been in the weeds. I've wrestled and dealt with this in very real ways and in messy ways that make some people uncomfortable. But I'm all about making people uncomfortable. So that's just the way it is. Life is messy, is what I'm getting at. But I know this, and I've learned this, and I've learned this only because I've been in the midst of that mess and discovered this, that the God who raised Jesus from the dead, the God who turned the greatest tragedy in the world into the greatest victory is still in the business of working all things. Hear that. All things for good. If you replace all things with your tragedy, what does that look like for you? For Brody, it was his abuse and his addiction and his pain, but God can use all things. For Deb and her family, it was their daughter's death, but God can use all things. What is it for you? Romans 8:28 tells you that in hospital stays, God works for the good. Even in divorce papers, God can work for the good. In prison terms, God can work for the good. In cancer diagnoses, God can still work for the good. God is the God of the overcomer. God takes you in your tragedy, and by his power, gives you the strength to overcome. You may be here this morning, and you may be experiencing the worst that life has to offer. But take hope. You may be experiencing the Saturday before your greatest resurrection. You could be hours from seeing your greatest tragedy can be God's greatest triumph. And this morning, as we close this service together, I'd invite the worship team to come back up as we close this time together. I want to invite you into this living hope that we have. Jesus gave everything for us. He came to show us the depths of his love, to show us the life that we could have and the significance and the turnaround that you can experience through him. That your life can have meaning, that your life can have hope, that you don't have to bear the weight of brokenness, bear the weight of guilt, bear the weight of shame, but that you can experience new life, that you can experience resurrection. So this morning, we're going to close with a song, and it's a song that is a song of invitation that reaches out and invites those who are hurting and broken, that reaches out to those who feel helpless and who long for rest and long for restoration and long for forgiveness, and invites you to come, whether it's literally or physically, coming to the altar, and at the altar encountering the risen Jesus who can work all things for the good of those who love him.